Okay, let us sit down.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
So, just to mention, they've been building the new kuti, so that's going very well down there. volunteers have been building it, so I think the temple is still raising a little bit more funds for that. The website is thecbswa.org, and the details are on the news page, I think. But which would be nice. So, Venerable Sudasi, the Sri Lankan monk, and I will be having that. We're sharing the hut, not the same time, but we'll have to work out what time of day we want to use it each. But it's nice, down there in the forest on the border of both monasteries. So next door is the Kusla Hermitage. And so it's lovely. And the other thing is there'll be a class on Sundays. Between 3:30 and 4:30, which is starting this Sunday, and we'll put it on the website. So I think the only 2 weeks that I won't be doing it. But also, even my father might be coming to some of them. It would be interesting. So, because I might be going to Thailand next year. So I'm trying to organize for that. So I thought I would help the template a little bit. So there will be similar to this evening's, but a bit more of the, some of the Thai Ajahn talks and some of the teachings as well that have been used in my practice. And maybe after that one, so we'll keep it to an hour, and then if people have questions, they're welcome to afterwards. So that's very good. Yes. So, this evening. So the most important thing when we come to the Dhamma is practice. Because if we don't practice, you can read all the texts and listen to all the greatest sermons and not get very far this life. So, you know, practice is where we... And we first we need to learn what the Dhamma is. And, you know, like when I first went to the monastery, I started by reading some of the Buddha's teachings. And then I came across Lumpo Tate's teachings and other teachings and living in a monastery under Ajahn Brahm. So we have weekly teachings. And, you know, so then you get a feel for what the Dhamma is. And the more you practice, then you get an idea how your mind works, you know, what's suitable meditation object, how to develop some wisdom. And like quite early on for me, the contemplation of the khandhas, which is the five components of a being, form, feeling, the labels of perceptions, volition of body, speech, or mind, and consciousness. So we're taught in Buddhism these things are arising and passing away. And these are the components of existence. And the Buddha had five similes for those. And very early on in my practice, I found that was very useful for me. I found a lot of the mindfulness techniques quite difficult. But I had a mind that you know, was interested in contemplation. And I actually found a teaching that the Buddha said that contemplating the five aggregates develops mindfulness and clear comprehension. So even though it's not in the Satipatthana Sutta, it shows you that actually if you keep your mind on Dhamma, you are developing mindfulness. You know? So it might not be the roadmap that most people take, but the idea is if we sustain our contemplations for long periods of time, then at that time unwholesome qualities aren't arising. You know? But it's not easy to sustain those contemplations. So that's why it's important to find a meditation object that suits us. And usually, you know, in Thailand, you know, we're taught simple meditation objects to begin with, like the breath or like the body posture. But eventually, if you can't get something to work, then you've got to find what actually works, you know. If you know, 5 years later, if you still don't have a meditation object, then maybe, you know, you need to focus. You need to be one-pointed in your efforts to be able to find a path, because, you know, we only have so many hours in a day and we never know when our last breath is going to be. And so that's why the Buddha taught the monks, you know, practice like your hair's on fire, practice like your clothes are on fire. And do you think you'd be lazy if your hair was petrol on it and it was on fire? I think you'd be lazy putting out that fire. And so that's why, you know, sometimes we need these contemplations to arouse energy and urgency. You know, as I did the talk the other week on Samvega and spiritual urgency, because, you know, how many times have we been born? How many lives have we lived? And so complacency or lack of practice, or lack of developing spiritual qualities, is an easy thing to creep in. You know? It's easy to get distracted. It's easy to take wrong paths. And so that's why in the middle of the Majjhima Paṭipaṭā, it's literally like that middle path of practice. You know, it's a straight line. and you're walking backwards and forwards, and developing the same path. And in the Eightfold Path, there's eight sections, but still you're going up and down the same path. The Buddha had the simile as like eight charioteers and their horses. And so one charioteer goes to the next charioteer, and then, you know, next chariot, and then gets off and gets on the next chariot and goes another section and gets off and gets on the another horse. Because in those days, they didn't have cars with petrols, so they'd tire out the horses. So you had to have eight lots of horses and carts, you know, to get your distance. And then when you got to the other end, you turn around and come back and do the same thing again. And so this is like the Eightfold Path. You have to develop right view, right thought, right speech, right intention, sorry, right speech, right action, right mode of living, like right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. So we have like these eight factors that harmonize, and each of them develop bit by bit. So to begin with, we don't know what right mindfulness is. We don't know what these things are. So we have to teach ourselves. And so in the process of practice, we use our own wisdom. So maybe, you know, maybe you're on a retreat and you get to practice a lot. So then, you know, in that retreat at some time, we want to contemplate as well. You know, like what is and is not the Eightfold Path? What is and is not right action? What is and is not right speech? Because unless we sharpen our own wisdom, you know, then it's just memory. It's just stuff in books. It's just other things people have told us that we think kind of might be true, but we haven't really brought it into our own hearts. And so that's why, you know, you've got to stumble a little bit and you try and make up your own understanding of it. And then the more you practice, the clearer those things become. And so, you know, in the Thai tradition, we're taught to develop the deep meditations as much as possible, so that, you know, to get as far as you can with developing up to Apana Samadhi, which is the fourth jhana, because then your mind is purified. But some people, no matter how much they practice, you know, they've just got to do what they can. You know, so wherever you're at, it doesn't really matter. The most important thing is that you're trying your best, and then you're trying to develop wisdom as well. Because wisdom is what will break us free. And so that's why when Ajahn Chah taught us, he said, you know, you don't have to go looking for a lot of things. When you're meditating and sense contact arises, you know, wisdom is born right there. You know, so why don't you like that sound? Why are you following after that thought? You know, why are you being lazy or whatever the hindrance that arising is? So right there, that's where we develop the wisdom. And then we need to sharpen our wisdom by reading the teachings of people who have really practiced, because that will help us show our shortcomings, our defilements, where we're not going right. Because if we just read all the ancient texts, all of the Buddha's teachings are just telling us the Four Noble Truths. They're just telling us the path of practice, how to firstly develop spiritual parami and perfection, but then to use that perfection to overcome suffering. And so even though there's, you know, all of these books for the monks and nuns and past lives of the Buddha and suttas of the teachings, suttas of all the teachings of the words spoken by the Buddha, you know, all of these things are pointing to one thing, practice. You know? So it's not as complicated as we make it out to be. So if we always just grab hold of the books and the ideas and never put it into practice, that's why sometimes I like the Dhammapada, because it's just single verses. And, you know, like the one with the untrained mind being like a fish thrashing in shallow water. So I always laugh when people tell me they can't meditate and can't practice. All they're saying is they've got an untrained mind and they're not happy with it. And rather than just saying, you know, my meditation is crazy, but I'm trying anyway. I haven't found my suitable means just yet. But also it's like our reaction to those thoughts. Do you react to sounds when you meditate? And so why are thoughts a problem? And so what we're learning to do when we're meditative is we're learning to develop a peaceful mind. And some people, maybe they have a crazy mind. Maybe thoughts arise, but we can get to the point where we don't react to those thoughts. We can just see them as Dhamma arambanas. They're just these mental phenomena arising and passing away that, you know, we have a tendency to proliferate about. So if we just see it as stories of the mind arising, stories of the mind passing away, now it's just like the dog. We don't have to react to the bark. You know, maybe it's going to bark for 4 hours the moment you sit down to meditate. But why make it a problem? You know, it's just sound. How many sounds have we heard since we've been born? Why is this one a problem? How many thoughts have we had since we're born? Why is this one a problem? And so this is where we don't have to look for many things. We just look in our experience, you know, what is our problem. And then the other thing is having a heart that is good. You know, and what is a heart that is good? It's a heart that's willing to practice, that's willing to put up with difficulties, willing to put up with sufferings, and give up its conveniences and worldly happinesses in order to practice. And that's why we have to build up things steadily, because, you know, in this world there's televisions and books and family and friends and walks in nature and holidays and all these things to distract people. But we can't take any of them with us. You know? When we die, none of those things are going to be any use for us. But what is going to be use for us is a peaceful mind, is a wise mind. Because if we have a wise mind at the moment of death, we weren't attached to any of our possessions or any of our loved ones. We weren't attached to our body. We weren't even attached to the clothes we're wearing. We just understand that, you know, these elements have come to their end. And now we fare according to our karma. Unless we're an arahant, then we finish with it. And we experience parinibbana, which, whatever that is, you know, the Buddha described parinibbana as like vast, like the great ocean. You know, the great unreckoning of becoming, you know, hard to describe. And so that's why he didn't really answer anybody's questions, because nibbana, parinibbana, is the extinction of suffering. So how can we, that is bundles of suffering, know what no suffering is? And so that's why he refused to answer all those questions. The closest you get to it, it's like the Dhamma element. The mind of an arahant knows the Dhamma purely. They know suffering, and they know the end of suffering. And they're totally finished with everything. But it's not nothing, because nothing is a formless state. So it's not infinite space, because that's a formless state. So all these things, all these concepts we have are to do with the five khandhas, to do with our own experience. And so in Buddhism, the Buddha, rather than, what's that simile to do with the poisoned arrow? So somebody gets shot by a poisoned arrow, and then the doctor comes along to treat him, to take out the poison arrow, and he's like, no, and first of all, I want to know who made the arrow, you know, and then I want to know what clan they were from, what family they were from. Now I want to know who made the shaft, you know, and all these questions. And by the time all those questions were answered and they got all that information, the guy would be dead. And so that's why all the Buddha says is, he said, like, all the things that the Buddha, a fully awakened Buddha, knows, like the Tathagata, the thus gone one, all the teachings that the Buddha knows, he was saying to the monk, says he was in the forest, like all these leaves in the forest. You know, he says, all these leaves, yet all I teach to you, and he picks up like a few dead leaves from, or leaves from the ground, like these few leaves in my hand. These leaves, you know, which is more, all the leaves in the forest or the leaves in my hand? And of course the monks are like, well, many of the leaves in the forest, you know, innumerable, and few of the leaves in your hand. And so a Buddha, even though they know all these things, so this is like us, you know, like with modern medicine and technology, and we think, you know, our science is so great, and all these things, you know, we pile up our defilements and think they're wonderful. But the Buddha is saying, you know, well, actually, you know, most things in this world are just suffering, you know. And so as lay people, you know, you can still enjoy, you can still with the precepts, you can still have these entertainments and other things, but the things that are really going to help us in life are the things that are teachings that lead us beyond suffering, so the path leading to the end of suffering. So the Four Noble Truths, there is suffering. So until we know there is suffering, we're not going to want to practice, you know? Because, you know, why would you practice if you think everything is happy? You know, life is happy, there's never going to be death. You know, this is kind of like the standard delusion we have in the back of our minds, which is why, you know, this kind of like this cloud comes over our mind and then and so you have suffering, and then the cause of suffering is basically it's desire, you know. It's our desires for the world, you know, and it's arising out of ignorance, which is like a lack of spiritual knowledge. So because we don't have the teachings of the Buddha, because we don't have, you know, great spiritual parami and power from our own practice over countless lifetimes, we don't have the ability to break free. So we may be able to become a god or a really excellent being, but we'll still be stuck ripening in attachment. So that's why ignorance and attachment, ignorance and desire, they go together. Because as much happiness as you get in the world, eventually those results will come to an end. You know? And so that's why the Buddha kind of he teaches us in a way, I think, called Nibbida, which is like where we get disenchanted with the world. Because even though we have happinesses and good things, he teaches us more refined happinesses, like to begin with generosity and moral precepts and mental cultivation, because these are things that make our mind luminous, and they make and these are things that are part of practice. Because then when we practice, you know, our heart is actually doing something which is very useful. And to begin with, that leads to better rebirth, but we can aspire from our practice, you know, to realize path and fruits, to actually become enlightened, to fulfill the teachings that the Buddha taught. And so they're the four stages of enlightenment, and the first one is literally called entering the stream of Dhamma, being a stream winner, a sotapanna. And, you know, the Buddha didn't want us to think these are things that can't be attained. But if we don't aspire to them, if we don't practice for them, then we'll never attain them. If we think it's going to happen next life, well, if we've never aspired for it in this life, why is it going to happen in next life? So it's like, you know, what we think we become. You know, so our thoughts create, you know, you can see it in our mind. Sometimes you think a thought and then next thing you know, you're speaking it. Next thing you know, you're acting on it. So these things are like dominoes. So if we're never creating the right intentions in the mind, if we're never creating the right thoughts in the mind, then how are we ever going to realize that path, that fruit? And then so, you know, each of those paths and fruits have to be realized through effort, through determination. And so the way is, you know, to do the practice, and then you have to determine, you know, may I realize these things? And then through your resolution, through your practice, these things are attainable. They're not something that is easy to attain, but if the causes are there, and the minimum cause is usually, you know, 7 days of mindfulness. It's the minimum cause. And so whether people, you know, you have a month of practice, 2 or 3 times a year where you're really earnest in the practice, and then you build all the causes up, and then you have an opportunity to realize it. Or even better, practice all the time, practice every day, and then have, you know, moon observance days or other times where you practice. But the idea is that, you know, what do we want for ourselves? You know, do we want the slow and painful path, or do we want the fast and quick path? So if we want the fast and quick path, well, what are we willing to sacrifice? What are we willing to do in order to realize that? And so this is the idea of having a love for the Dhamma, So where we're willing to put up with difficulties, you know, maybe, you know, we've got to learn to wake up early, learn to stay up later, learn to be more secluded and not talk with people, learn as much and, you know, learn to limit and have moderation in our actions. So in the world, if you, you know, you've got movies and televisions, we'll start by knowing the things that are going into your mind. You know, so it might be okay to have entertainment or read a book or something, but, you know the content. You know, don't get lost in those things. So you still have mindfulness. And then, you know, we know moderation. So if somebody has a lot of lust, then you determine certain kinds of thoughts that you're never going to allow to arise in your mind. If somebody has a lot of greed, then you find a way of creating, you know, restraint and composure. So you know, maybe you need to contemplate before eating or contemplate before going shopping or whatever it is, so that can quell those desires. And so the practice is very individual, but it all goes together, because we have from when we wake up in the morning to when we go to sleep at night. That's practice. And the meditation is just a formal posture. As Ajahn Chah said, you know, when you open your eyes, don't stop meditating. You know, don't throw it all away and wait till you meditate again. It's a very slow and painful way of practicing. So, and he would say that, you know, if that's the way you practice, now, well, you better get your act together quick, because that's, you know, a very slow and painful way of practicing. And, you know, we've all seen it, you know. I don't know if sometimes you have a meditation and then you get up and you get lost in something or you react to something. So the meditation without mindfulness through the day is not making best use of our mind. So, yeah. So that was the resulting from the little talk I gave at lunch today on cause and effect. Just popped into my head from that, because if we don't put in the causes, then we know what the effect will be. You know, so we can just ask ourselves, you know, am I putting in the causes that are leading me in this direction or not? And if not, well, when am I going to start putting those causes in? You know, make a deadline. Okay, well, I'm going to start, you know, meditating half an hour a day, or add an extra half an hour a day onto what my existing practice is. And you know, I'm going to make one day a week where I don't talk to people and, you know, be a bit more spiritual or whatever it is, you know. Our own practice is personal. But, and there is a path as well. Some people, maybe if you don't meditate a lot, you find meditation isn't for you as much, then the five precepts, you know, they're the minimum basis. But take them into the mind. You know, so you would rather die than break these things. And that's the level that it's required to really have strong mindfulness. And then find a way of being inspired. Because then generosity, I know we're very comfortable in the West, but, you know, learning generosity is a difficult thing. So you've got to read the teachings of the Arahants and read the teachings of the Buddha and learn what they actually say. And what does it actually mean to be generous? What does it mean to be thankful and grateful? And then apply these things. You know, if we're not naturally a generous person, if we're not naturally thankful and grateful, if we're not naturally have a heart of benevolence and compassion, and then, you know, how are we going to train in these things? How are we going to balance out our personality? So they're not a be or end all, but they're certainly a good beginning, a good foundation. And, you know, it's one thing, you know, I came into this life very generous. Had a lot of problems, but one thing I have is generosity. And it's a good start, because it means you have a bright mind. So I really recommend making the sila and the generosity a foundation. And then reflect on those things, you know. And so that when I learned the recollection of sila, which is the precepts, so whatever your precepts are, whether 5, 8, 10, 227 or whatever, you know, the Buddhist teaching was, it's like, you know, this virtuous conduct is unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped at, leading to samadhi. And the same with the recollections of the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, same with the recollection of generosity. These things are a foundation for samadhi. So people think they can't meditate, and you just go the other way. You know, you learn how to practice, learn how to be inspired by the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, learn how to be inspired by generosity, how to be inspired by sila. These are other paths to develop samadhi, because ultimately samadhi is strength of mind. How do we sustain our mind? You know, so and one final thing. When I started practice, I thought it's better to have 10,000 wholesome thoughts than one unwholesome thought. Meaning that, you know, sometimes you really have to struggle with your mind. Don't believe your own moods. Don't believe your own stories. You've got to be willing to actually try and practice. And then you don't want to overdo it, but also you don't want to underdo it. So you've got to know how, like a good teacher, you know, who's got a student who knows when the student's quite bright and they're being lazy, or another one's trying really hard, but they're doing their best. You know, so you've got to know where you're at. And it's hard in the West because we don't have so many teachers. So you've got to use wisdom and not be too hard on yourself, but also not let yourself be lazy. Okay, so that's the Dhamma talk for the evening. Okay, just get yourself in comfortable position. Turn on. Okay, so just start by coming into the present. Checking the bodily posture, relaxing the body. Setting up our mind for a half an hour meditation. Just go through the body and check that everything is relaxed. If we're tired, then try and maybe straighten the spine, sit more upright. Suspending the body can help wake one up. Usually people are a bit more restless or worried or something, have tension in the body. So just start by relaxing the body. Putting down all that tension, busyness, worldliness, tendency to react, to chase after. Put it all down. See if there's any difficult part lingering in the body. Just bring some kindness to that area. Relaxation, accepting it as it is. Not needing to react or be averse to anything. body relax, relax the eyes, our physical eyes and our spiritual eyes. Just relax the eyes completely. We want to live in spiritual darkness with spiritual vision. Part of relaxing the eyes is seeing how much we can just quiet down and become still. Giving up the tendency of needing to go anywhere. Body relaxed and the eyes relaxed. Now we give up the asavas, which is the tendency of the mind to flow out into the world. Whatever asavas, just give them up. Just let the mind be with the mind. Sense of uprightness, inner brightness and repose. If our mind's still busy, maybe we just look at the hindrances. See if sense desire is arising. We just give it up. If anger or irritation is arising, we just give it up. Dullness and drowsiness is arising. Just give it up with a sense of inner luminosity, awakeness. If restlessness and worry is arising, just let the mind become like a still lake. If doubt is arising, just have confidence and faith in our practice. Like an island unto ourselves, not a care in the world, just with a heart of Dhamma. And in the course of the meditation, if any hindrance arises, just see it as an impersonal hindrance arising and let it pass away. It's nothing to do with us, it's just an asava. Let the mind come back to be with the mind, the heart, in the present. Now is the time to bring up our chosen theme of meditation. Otherwise, maybe like Buddha, Bud with the in-breath, Do with the out-breath. Or awake, awake, and peaceful, peaceful. Once we have our chosen theme, we determine to keep with it for the meditation. Gently and patiently sustain it for the meditation. We go off. When we notice, we just let go. In a gentle way, come back and start a meditation. If we ever get really lost, we can take a few deep breaths and just start again. Buddha, Buddha, usually we have a chosen way of being with the breath. Just allow the breath to be comfortable. Comfortable and ease, at ease. Mind of a diligent student, doing our best with a good heart. beside for the next 15 minutes. Let's do our best to sustain the meditation. Thank you. So just see how the mind is after half an hour of meditation. The attitude that we had. The way we nurtured our mindfulness. The way we dealt with any sense contact or thoughts. And the result. Cause and effect. In our own time, we may end the meditation. Let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration.
Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life, may they soon attain the threefold bliss, and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord, the Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Sadhu, sadhu, and the animal dinner, in brief. Yatha varivaha pura pariparanti sagarang evang eva ito dinam petanang upakapati chitang patitang tunghang kipameva samijatu sabeparantu sangapa chandu panara soyata manichotira soyata subityo vivachantu sabaroko vinasatu mate pavantvantarayo sukhitika yuko pava apiva tannasili sanichan utapachayino chataro dhamma vatanti ayuvano sukham.
Good evening.